Another fine show brought to you by the Law of Attraction Radio Network. The Law of Attraction Talk Radio is the radio show that is changing the world through science and spirituality as we realize that our well-being and our happiness is through our own thoughts. The Law of Attraction Talk Radio, the Jules. Well, welcome to Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I'm Jules from beautiful and refreshing Southern California. Well, I have got to tell you that tonight is the most important show I've ever done after 3.5 years of broadcasting. Even after 200 episodes of talking about quantum physics, spiritual and metaphysical applications of the Law of Attraction, tonight we have indisputable facts and studies that prove the existence of the Law of Attraction through the biological and imaging of the brain. You know, just a few weeks ago, I was confronted by two people who thought the Law of Attraction was rubbish. And I even had two guests come on my show and tell me that they didn't believe in the Law of Attraction. Fred Allen Wolf from the movie The Secret, for one, and another one was Guy Finley. They don't believe in the Law of Attraction. Well, tonight they may want to reconsider their beliefs because we have Sereni Pillay, MD, Assistant Clinical Professor at Harvard Medical School with us tonight, telling us that, yes, the Law of Attraction is real and provable. Tonight, science and spirituality not only got married, but they just birthed a beautiful baby, all through the Law of Attraction. Stay with us. You are listening to your daily dose of well-being and inspiration on Law of Attraction Radio Network at loaradionetwork.com. Do you live in Los Angeles? Well, the Law of Attraction Radio Network is coming your way in person with interactive workshops on October 29th through the 31st. If you want amazing healing or to communicate with a loved one that has passed or to be hypnotized to release your financial blocks or to understand the energetics behind finding and keeping your soulmate or to receive insightful and personal messages from non-physical entities known as Tara, or to simply gain more information about applying the Law of Attraction in your life, then this is the place for you to be. Sign up for just one workshop or all of them. If you have issues with love, money, health, or well-being, then come meet us for some incredible interaction. Go to loaradionetwork.com and visit the workshop page where you can purchase the tickets right from there. October 29th through the 31st. We'll see you there. Real fast, don't forget to sign up for the LA workshops. The discounts end on October 15th. By the way, if you want to be updated on shows or events, send me your email address or put it in the box on my host page. Be in the know by allowing me to send you the updates. Okay, now let's get on with the most wonderful show tonight. If you have not heard of Sereni Pillay, then I am so honored to introduce you to him. Sereni Pillay, MD, is a name that you will now know from this point on, as it becomes even more familiar than Deepak Chopra or Wayne Dyer. Now, I'm going to read his credentials because you need to fully understand that Dr. Pillay is not only brilliant, but has the standing to qualify his answers. Sereni Pillay, MD, is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School in Boston. Dr. Pillay is also the former director of the Outpatient Anxiety Disorders Program and the Panic Disorders Research Program in the Brain Imagery Laboratory at McLean Hospital. Dr. Pillay graduated at the top of his class at medical school. During his residency training at Harvard Medical School, he won more awards than any other resident student at Harvard and was among the top three award winners in the U.S. He has been federally funded brain imaging researcher for 17 years and an internationally respected expert in stress, anxiety, and fear. He is much sought after by the media, having been featured by the Boston Globe, Newsweek, Woman's World, and Men's Health, as well as New England Cable News and Fox TV in New York, Boston, and Utah. Soon, I predict, Dr. Pillay will be known as the one person who actually verified the validity behind the law of attraction as it now becomes an accepted and common approach to everyday living. In other words, the law of attraction is now out of the closet and mainstream. One more thing about Dr. Pillay. He has written a book called Life Unlocked, 7 Revolutionary Lessons to Overcome Fear. This is the book that you have been waiting for, and this is the only book you need to have if you truly want to understand the law of attraction. Even though he doesn't call it the law of attraction, it is exactly what the book is about. Do not go another day without reading Life Unlocked. I have placed this book on my host page and on Law of Attraction Radio Network's must-have books. And by the way, you need to know that I'm not being paid to say this because I believe this is the most powerful book that you need to read. Last year, Dave, a longtime listener, sent me an article written by Dr. Pillay and the Law of Attraction. Well, Dr. Pillay and I connected, but somehow we never set the date for the interview. Just last week, Dr. Pillay contacted me again, and as it happens with the Law of Attraction, my original guest had canceled, leaving me wide open to bring Dr. Pillay on this week. So not only is the timing perfect, but it's apparent that this is the message that we need to put out to the world right now. Welcome, Dr. Pillay, to Law of Attraction Talk Radio.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
You know, I became familiar with your work through that article that you wrote in March 2009 about the law of attraction. And it was surprising to me that here you are, medical doctor at Harvard, even touching on the subject. What made you get into the law of attraction?
Well, you know, I felt that there were a lot of spiritual principles and a lot of things that I had encountered and encountered in the people I had worked with that rung true. And I thought there were a large number of people who were not able to relate to these ideas through the language of spirituality. And through my brain imaging research, what I had seen was that brain imaging was really a very powerful metaphor for describing a lot of spiritual phenomena. And so I thought it would be a great opportunity to apply the brain imaging research to ideas around spirituality so that more people could begin to understand that this was not just theoretical, but that on several levels, this principle was actually visible.
Wow, I am so delighted that there's something other than spirituality and quantum mechanics that can actually prove that the law of attraction exists.
Right. Well, you know, I feel the fact that we're talking to each other is really evidence of the fact that there's some connection between people who believe in the law of attraction sort of fundamentally and people who do believe in that and who have biological ideas around that as well.
Let's dive in to the first study about the amygdala and fear. This in itself is a way to understand about the law of attraction. So if you could explain.
Well, a couple of different things. So firstly, the amygdala is really the emotion processor in the brain. And one of the emotions that it processes is fear. And usually fear makes it to the head of the line because the amygdala processes emotions by impact factor. So if an emotion has a potentially high impact, like fear, the amygdala will pick that up. And the idea is that from an evolutionary perspective, scientists believe that fear was there to protect us and that the amygdala would need to pick that up in order to protect us from potential threats. Well, it turns out that this fear that we're feeling is actually not just contained within our bodies, but can actually influence the brains of people around us. So one of the experiments that I have done, and that many other people have done as well, is we ask people to lie in a brain imaging scanner, and when they're lying in a brain imaging scanner, we show them pictures of either threatening or fearful faces. And if we show them these pictures consciously, what we find is that the amygdala, the fear processor, activates. And this then tells us that the amygdala in the brain of the person who's lying in the scanner is the part of the brain that activates when it is exposed to fear. But one of the more important and interesting findings is that we have ways in which we can present these faces unconsciously. If we present the faces between 10 to 30 milliseconds, it's too fast for the conscious brain to pick this up. So if you ask the person, what did you see? They'll say, I saw nothing. But if you actually then look at the brain and you try to look at the amygdala to see what's happening, the amygdala activates. And the amygdala is so sensitive to fear that not only is it will it activate to conscious and unconscious fear, but even in blind people, the amygdala will activate if you show them fearful or threatening pictures.
Wow, blind people.
Telling us that the fear center in the brain is open to emotions from the outside, and that if we show people fear, then the fear registers in your brain, which suggests to us then, in terms of the law of attraction, that if we put out fear, that is what we generate in the brains of others as well.
So this shows that you do project out your fear onto others. Is this part of the mirroring of the neurons?
Yes, it's related to that. The amygdala phenomenon is a separate phenomenon, but in addition to that, we also have mirror neurons in our brains, and these mirror neurons represent not just actions of other people, but thoughts and emotions and intentions as well. So what this means is that if you have any other kind of expression, not just fear, but if you put out a positive emotion, it activates that same emotional system in the brain of someone who is around you. And what's interesting about a lot of these findings, and especially found in relation to fear, is that it doesn't have to be conscious. It can be outside of conscious awareness as well. So mirror neurons literally set up a mirroring pathway in the brain of the observer so that your emotions are felt by them immediately, suggesting to us that the law of attraction, when it comes to emotions, you know, a lot of people will say, how come I don't attract people who are positive towards me? And how come whenever I'm around people, I don't feel a positive vibe? Well, part of what we need to figure out is what are we putting out there? Because if we're putting out negative intentions, and if we're putting out negative vibes, then what we get back biologically, because of those mirror neuron systems, is negative vibes as well. Because these negative emotions are being represented in negative emotional systems in the brain.
Bingo. You know, we've been talking about this for years, but this is the first time that it's actually been studied and presented as the law of attraction. Have you done studies about the energy field surrounding the body or the auras?
Well, vibrations and energy fields have not been studied as well by functional brain imaging researchers. But what we do know is that, you know, when sometimes people feel a kind of spiritual energy and they feel transcendent in a certain way, either because they're meditating or because they're experiencing a mindful state or a particularly restful state that's not just rest but transcendence, what we know is that this state of transcendence correlates with what we call alpha coherence, which means that the different parts of the frontal lobe of the brain are then more coherent. They all talk to each other in a much more synchronous way. And so when we talk about energy fields, about synchronicity, what we're really talking about is different parts of the frontal lobe being coordinated. And the idea of energy fields is really not that abstract, because if you think about it, what are emotions and what are thoughts? Emotions and thoughts are represented by electrical currents in the brain. And we know that when electrical current flows through a conductor, that it generates energy. So the idea that energy is an absurd concept or that it's too abstract doesn't make sense to me, because thoughts and feelings are electrical impulses passing through the brain, they naturally generate an energy current.
What's your take on energy healing?
So, you know, I've actually written about this as well, and my take on this is that I don't think we have a standardized method that's been proven yet. You know, in any research, we have different levels of evidence. We have what we call a single case study. We have case histories, which we call sort of several anecdotes. We have open trials, and then we have sort of double-blind placebo-controlled trials. When it comes to the actual research, we have several case studies, several anecdotes, and there are some open trials that show that there is a possibility that energy healing is actually having an effect. Now, having said that, there have been studies that have shown no effects of energy and no effects of prayer, for example. But what I would say about these is that we still have to refine our methodologies, because we don't know if all the practitioners are giving up the same energy to be able to produce that effect. And we don't know exactly how we can quantify some of this energy. So my personal feeling is that energy healing is possible because I have seen and believe in the anecdotes. I would be very open to a researcher's argument that we don't have enough evidence yet, but I would say that we do have some level of evidence, enough to have us pursue this, to answer those questions at a more detailed research level.
You just mentioned the word placebo, which happens to be about the belief if something is going to help you or not. Isn't energy healing really about tapping into the person's belief in order for them to heal themselves?
Very much so. You know, when people talk about placebo, it's such a confusing construct to me, because people talk about it as though it's something false or nothing, when in fact, the studies have shown that if you are hopeful versus, and especially hopeful about the future versus being hopeless or fearful, hope can actually displace fear from the amygdala. And partly as a result of that, you can experience pain relief, literal pain relief, much more if you are hopeful than if you're not. Now, some people would say, well, you know, the hope is just placebo. Well, you can call it what you want, but what matters in the end is whether you're experiencing that pain or not. And if you're experiencing less pain because you are more hopeful, then to me that says that hope is actually a very helpful emotional state to be feeling, because it actually impacts the way your body's working and how you perceive what's going on in your body.
Dr. Pillay, along the same lines, Dr. Bruce Lipton talks about the cells and their antennas picking up the emotions, which actually brings about the healing or the dis-ease from the emotions of the person. Is there validity to that?
Well, again, I think we don't have enough evidence, but I'll tell you some of the reasons that I believe that this is possible. You know, one of the things that we know about loneliness, for example, is that loneliness as a state, you know, studies have looked at lonely people versus non-lonely people and have found that lonely people have a decrease in the fighter cells in the body, the CD4 count, suggesting that the way that you feel interacts with what's going on with the cells. Now, some people would say, oh, that just sounds so crazy. You know, why would you even imagine that what you think can affect what's going on in your body? Well, think about something simple like anxiety. If you're anxious, it can affect your heart rate. And what is your heart? Your heart is an organ. And what is that organ made of? It's made out of cells. So if anxiety can transmit impulses to affect cells in the heart, and if loneliness can affect cells in the blood, why would we not want to believe that cells are affected by our emotions?
Exactly. Well put. You know, this is about the law of attraction and the power behind our thoughts and emotions. I love it. Where does spirituality come into play here? Let's talk about spiritual perception, because I read in your article that spiritual practices actually affect the brain.
Very much so. In fact, you know, in my book, Life Unlocked, one of the things that I do in every chapter, and I describe 7 revolutionary ways to overcome fear. And a lot of people thought, well, this is since it's based in brain science, it's going to be about scientific evidence that has nothing to do with spirituality. But in fact, throughout the book, in every chapter, I use what I call a map change approach, where the M stands for meditation, the A for attention, and the P for psychological insight. And a lot of studies have shown that in a large number of these conditions, there's significant scientific evidence to support the use of meditation. What meditation does is, aside from creating this greater coordination in your frontal lobe, it creates what we call a greater state of mindfulness. And when we talk about meditation, I would say that this would apply to most forms of meditation practiced well, but the research that we have is mostly on mindfulness meditation, transcendental meditation, and compassion meditation. And we have some research on Qigong as well. What I would say is that when we're meditating, it actually has an impact on the amygdala. And the reason I would say that is a recent study looked at people under two conditions. It looked at people who were doing what we call cognitive reflection, you know, asking why did I feel this and why did this happen and how does, you know, asking lots of questions and reflecting. And when they looked at amygdala activation, they found that amygdala activation was increased when we have cognitive reflection. However, when we have emotional introspection, which is simply placing your attention on where you feel the emotion in your body, letting the attention be there without judgment, without criticism, without asking millions of questions, the activation of the amygdala decreases, suggesting that pure emotional introspection, simply internalizing attention, placing it on where you feel the emotion in your body, can decrease activation of the fear center in the brain. Wow. These two pieces of evidence, coordination in the frontal lobe, as well as this finding that the amygdala activation can actually decrease in meditation, are very powerful suggestions that the meditative state or the spiritual state can significantly impact emotions. But it doesn't just stop there. It actually goes on to habits that people have. There have been some initial studies that show pretty convincingly and published in reputable journals that transcendental meditation can decrease cigarette smoking in youth. And in addition to that, there have been studies that show that meditation, it was the first treatment to be found to be effective in the prevention and treatment of hypertension in a mainstream cardiac journal, suggesting that, once again, there is a connection between the mind and the body. And I have no idea why people reject this idea that there is a connection between the mind and the body, because the brain, which is responsible for mediating a lot of these emotional states, is connected to the rest of the body. In fact, the rest of the body relies on the brain. So if we believe that emotions are generated by, or at least mediated by, the brain, why wouldn't we think that they would affect the rest of our organs? If you look at the top 10 list of any cancer or most medical diseases, you will, somewhere on that list you will find stress. Because stress is one of those conditions that activates a whole lot of abnormal hormonal systems in the brain that then impacts your organs throughout the rest of your body. So there again we have some evidence that stress can impact the biology of your body, which can then impact the rest of your body. It's not that nebulous. Stress, depression, anxiety, negative emotional states are all represented by chemicals in the brain. And these chemicals affect the way in which nerve impulses are transmitted. And these nerves eventually make connection with different organs. So it's a direct correlation. And the idea that there is no connection between the way we feel and what's happening to us physically, to me, doesn't make sense because of what I just said.
Wonderful. But here's hoping Western medicine picks up on that and starts practicing it.
I think it's really time for us to learn from each other. You know, I think that it's a time where we need to have different kinds of healers communicate. You know, in my own practice, I've often worked with people who come from a whole lot of different domains, depending on what the particular client wants. You know, I myself do not do energy healing professionally. So when I worked with a client who wanted to work with an energy healer, what I said to her was, why don't I do what I do, and we'll get an energy healer, and then throughout the course of the work with you, we'll have everyone in the same room so that everybody can contribute their own perspective. And this actually ended up being very effective for her, because she was then able to bridge, by having a Western medicine and having an energy healer in the same room, she was able to bridge disparate parts of herself. Because there was a part of herself that was very objective and sort of leaning toward some of the fundamental constructs in Western medicine, and there was a part of herself that was much more abstract and didn't really rely on concreteness to find meaning. And when she could find that all the different kinds of healers could talk to each other, she actually felt this coherence within herself and actually changed a lot of her self-destructive behavior.
You know, you are giving me such hope that we're finally on the same path, being the alternative medicines and Western medicines are taking the best of each and moving forward. I'm delighted to hear that. Now, I'm a hypnotherapist, and I am absolutely amazed that people do not understand the power of their mind over their emotions. Many of them don't even realize that they can simply choose to feel better or choose to feel miserable.
I think we have control over a significant number of things when it comes to our minds. And, you know, again, I think hypnotherapy is also a good example of a kind of treatment that people think of as being either an alternate treatment or a fringe treatment. The truth is, you know, I did part of my rotation, my consultation liaison psychiatry rotation at Massachusetts General Hospital. And when we worked with medically ill patients, one of the techniques that we were taught to use was hypnotherapy. And the reason was that by directing people's attention away from the pain, by having them learn that they can control what they're becoming aware of, you can actually significantly decrease the amount of pain that they're feeling. In fact, several brain imaging studies have been done to show that if you take two groups of people and you administer the same amount of pain, and what they do is they use electrodes and they administer the same amount of charge to both groups of people, the group that pays attention to the pain reports a much higher pain level than the group that doesn't. And this correlates with not just the fear center of the brain. In fact, there's a much stronger correlation with the attentional center of the brain. So the amount of pain you're feeling in life may not necessarily be related to the actual pain that's being delivered, but what you're paying attention to. And in hypnotherapy, what you're teaching people is that their attachment to their pain or to their discomfort with their attention can be changed. That by giving themselves to the images that you're introducing or to the idea or the hope or even the possibility of detaching their attention from their previous source of distress, they can actually find a much greater level of relief within themselves, by themselves. And this, I think, is one of the most replicated findings in the pain research right now. And I think there'd be very few pain researchers who would say to you that, in fact, most people would say that attentional mechanisms are one of the most important things to concentrate on when you're thinking about relieving internal distress.
You have a brilliant visualization technique. As a matter of fact, it's so good and so logical that it probably would put the mind movies out of business. Tell us about that.
Well, exactly. You know, a lot of people, when you talk about visualization, they roll their eyes or say, come on, you know, I've read The Secret. I've been trying to manifest this for a long time. Nothing happens. Well, simply doing something doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get what the outcome is. You know, for example, if I said to you, you know, do you want to build more muscle mass? And you said, sure. And if I said, well, the way to do that is to go to the gym. If you simply walked to the gym, didn't lift anything up, and then left, you wouldn't build muscle mass. If you walked to the gym and lifted 5-pound weights for 6 months, you would build very little muscle mass. You know, just what you do at the gym matters. In the same way, what you do with your visualization matters. And what the brain imaging studies have found is that when we perform actions, we activate the action center of the brain. When we are visualizing what we call motor imagery, So when we are visualizing actions, this also activates the action center of the brain. It doesn't activate it at the same level as an action because the action would then occur, but it activates it at a sub-threshold level and brings you closer to executing the correct action. What we find, though, and this is really interesting, is that when you have a mental image, it activates certain parts of the brain. When you are stressed, stress deactivates the same parts of the brain that are needed to mount an image. And as a result, the action center of your brain doesn't get a strong enough image because stress is turning the volume down on that image. So the first thing is that if you're trying to visualize, visualizing in a stress-free state will really help your brain keep the image, and it will help communicate that image to the action center of your brain. Perhaps one of the most interesting findings about it is that studies have shown that when we visualize in the first person, it activates the action center of the brain much more. And what that means, I'll give you an example of that. So I'll sometimes say to people, what do you imagine when you're running a 100-meter race? And people will say, you know, I see myself in black shorts, a white shirt, it's a sunny day, I can see the number in the wind on my back. And I'll say, that's fine, but that's seeing yourself in the third person. If you're actually in the race, you won't be seeing yourself. All you'll be seeing is the finish line. And all you'll be feeling is being in the race. And when you're visualizing and you're in the race, rather than looking at yourself, you activate the action center of the brain much more. What's more is that studies have shown that if you don't believe that something is possible, the imagery will not be powerful enough to stimulate the action center in the brain. A literal example is that when you put people in a brain imaging scanner and you ask them to rotate their hands to 30 degrees, it's possible to rotate your hand to 30 degrees, so it activates the action center of the brain. If you then say to them, imagine rotating your hand to 30 degrees, it will still activate the action center in the brain. If, however, you say rotate your hand 180 degrees, because you believe it's not possible and it isn't, what ends up happening is the action center of the brain goes to sleep. It doesn't even try to mount the image. So when it comes to our own hopes and dreams, if we can believe that something is achievable, we're much more likely to get there. You know, a classic example of this is the example of Roger Bannister, who broke the record for the 4-minute mile. And prior to his breaking that record, everybody said, there's no way you could run the mile in 4 minutes or under. And what Roger Bannister did was he ran that mile in under 4 minutes, and directly after he broke that record, several people broke it in the year after that, suggesting that once you know that something is possible, your brain will take you to that place. So why not believe that something's possible if you actually have a dream or hope so that you can allow your brain to stay online to find the solutions that you need?
And that's why you wrote about the fear of success in your book, because that fear actually stops you from achieving your goal.
Very much so. You know, I think fear of success is such a counterintuitive sort of idea. You know, when I was thinking about the title of the book and thinking about Life Unlocked, what I was thinking was that the idea that you could reverse fear of success is a key that a lot of people would not think about, because most people believe that they want success. And that's because most people believe their conscious mind. Several brain imaging studies have now shown us that the unconscious exists. And what we do know is that a lot of times, even though consciously we may say to ourselves, I want success, there are a number of fears that pull us in the opposite direction. There's the fear that we might not be able to maintain that success. There's the fear that other people will expect more from us. There's the fear that we will actually not just not be able to maintain it, but fall from that height. You know, there's the disorientation of being a leader, because when you're a follower, there's always someone in front of you. But if you're extremely successful, you are the leader, and so you have that responsibility, and it can be disorienting. All of these fears are operating at what we call a subconscious or unconscious level, and they work against your conscious desire for success. So when you find yourself stuck in a particular way in life, part of what you need to ask yourself is, even though I'm thinking this consciously, what's going on unconsciously that I can't bring myself to the place that I want to bring myself to. And the idea is not just to rely on your conscious thoughts, but to recognize that there are fears that most likely are represented in your brain that work against your conscious strive for success.
You know, when people say that the law of attraction doesn't work for me, may actually have that fear of success stopping them from going forward.
Well, exactly. And, you know, again, you know, this makes me think also of notions like the power of intention. A lot of people sort of think of that as also being an abstraction, but the truth is it's not. When you think about what intention is, you know, part of the reason I wrote the book was because I had just become so frustrated that there were so many people filled with immense potential and a lot of possibility who were just not able to reach that potential. And what I felt was that part of what was happening was that there wasn't something concrete enough for them to hold on to try to understand how they were working against themselves. So one of the basic principles of this book is that there, in order to get where you want to get to in life, you have to act, which means that you have to activate the action center of your brain. The action center of your brain needs information. It needs some kind of motor map. And these motor maps hold the intentions. And the motor maps are what the action center will read in order to go where it needs to go. But it also needs the brain's parietal lobe, which is the navigator, which will tell it how to get there. Now, all of these centers of the brain, in the frontal cortex and in the frontal parietal cortex, are part of the attentional system of the brain. And they are directly connected to the fear center in the brain, the amygdala. So when you have fear, you get an earthquake in the amygdala or shock waves in the amygdala that directly spread into where the brain is trying to act and plan and move. And the intention, which are these little metaphorical booklets of information that are being used so that the action center can know where to go, becomes disrupted. And so when you live your life without intention, what ends up happening is you end up submitting to your fear. And by addressing your fears, you can release yourself more to your intentions, which are simply these plans that your brain puts together that it uses to communicate to the action center to get to where you want to get to. So part of what I recommend in the book, you know, in every chapter, there's a meditation portion, there's an attention portion, and then there's a psychological insight portion, and there are exercises for improving attention and exercises related to psychological insights, which initially, you know, I would not recommend sort of reading the entire book to do every single exercise, but to choose at least one or two exercises that you can take to, and then to say to yourself, why don't I live my life or reframe what's going on in my life so that I can create permission within my brain to do what I need to do? You know, part of what, one of the reasons I'm a huge believer in optimism is not that I'm a believer in cheerleading. What I'm really a believer in is the permission that the brain needs to pursue a course of action. Because when you're optimistic, you're essentially telling the brain a solution is possible, and you're allowing the brain to come up with a plan to get you to your goal. When you're pessimistic, you're essentially telling the brain to go to sleep. And so the brain says, thank you very much, good night. I'm not going to try to find a solution. And then that becomes self-reinforcing because then you don't know how to get there and your pessimism becomes worse. But if you can be fundamentally dedicated to optimism, which is simply the permission for your brain to come up with a solution and not expect an instant answer, my belief is that this will put your brain in a much more sort of likely state to find a solution than if it's turned off by your pessimism.
Although the concepts are the same, the way that you are putting it makes so much sense. Giving ourselves permission to believe, that's absolutely brilliant.
I'm so glad that you feel that way, because I think asking it is given, the secret, the power of intention, are all sort of magnificent descriptions of human potential and human capacity. And what I do with this book is add to that by providing a biological perspective so that we have another perspective that we can add to this. And I think the more dimensions that we can use to examine these ideas, the more likely we are to be able to motivate ourselves to actually institute a plan of action so that we can get to our fundamental goals.
Okay, just to confirm, biologically, the law of attraction is authentic and real.
That's correct. The idea that like begets like has a lot of evidence to support it in the brain imaging literature.
Let's go deeper into your book. You mentioned the fear of success and intention. What else is in the book?
Well, there are a number of different concepts that I mentioned in the book. The book starts out with describing the experiments in conscious and unconscious fear, then goes on to describe how a positive and attentive life can prevent you from falling into dread, because so many people experience dread. You know, you get up on a Monday morning and you have to go to work, people feel dread. You know, if they have anything coming up, a payment, they feel dread. The question is how to release yourself from that dread. I would say that particular chapter is important for a lot of people because so many people feel dread and really hate that feeling of anticipation. I would say another really important chapter in that book is the chapter on emotional superglue. You know, how to develop emotional superglue after trauma. Because so many people have had traumatic events that have impacted their lives. And what a lot of people don't know is that these traumas, these emotional disruptions, can disrupt your brain as well. Studies have shown that the long-term memory center of your brain, the hippocampus, may be smaller. There may be less blood flow. There may be heightened activation of your amygdala or your fear center in the brain. And once you realize that trauma can actually impact your brain, aside from doing what you've been doing so far, part of what you can do is actually ask yourself, well, what can I do to change my brain activation? How can I redirect flow in the hippocampus? What can I do to decrease the blood flow in the amygdala? And, you know, just one simple example that I describe in more detail in the book is meditation has been found to be helpful in trauma because it decreases amygdala activation. But in addition to that, one of the more recent findings, which is, I think, difficult to bear, but I think it's worth considering, is that in acute traumatic situations, you know, when there are disasters, one of the things that people have been doing for a long time is debriefing. They've essentially been repeating the trauma and the story over and over again. And what the studies show is that people who debrief more end up taking a much longer time to heal. And what the studies show is that rather than placing your attention on repeated description of the trauma, if you have someone to help you redirect your attention to your resilience, because the reality is that you've survived the trauma. And as much as the trauma has been horrific, it's also pretty amazing that you have survived. And if you can then learn how to appreciate your own resilience, studies show that resiliency training actually helps you develop the superglue even more, and that debriefing can disrupt this. So that's the kind of principle that's described in that chapter. There's also, you know, a significant number of references to things around money and things around the recession. There's a chapter on prejudice, which, you know, it's a controversial chapter because really, you know, I don't think anybody wants to be identified as being prejudiced, but the studies show that if you look at prejudice, the external descriptions of our prejudice do not correlate with what's going on in the brain. It's actually when we test unconscious prejudice that we see that there's a correlation between this and amygdala activation. And really what I suggest in relation to this is that rather than going around bullying people into not being prejudiced, if we can just accept that many of our brains have been conditioned socially to have some level of prejudice about something, and if we can develop an open dialogue about it in the spirit of changing it without feeling like we have to bully someone else or bully ourselves, in a large number of situations, we're much more likely to transform society. I mean, there are extreme cases where there's a lot of violence and, you know, there's murder and, you know, there's extreme injustice where I think that it's harder to wait in order to make these changes. But for by and large, for a large part of how people interact, I think having a different attitude toward prejudice, recognizing that you may not always intend to be, that someone who is being that way may benefit from being shown that they're being without necessarily being screamed at, that if you do that, you're really addressing the biological systems for prejudice in a much more helpful manner than simply trying to bully someone into being something, because they may say to you what you want to hear, but they may not necessarily feel that.
Can you put that in more of today's terms? Are you saying that we need to become more tolerant?
I think tolerance is helpful because it opens up the conversation. But I think the second step needs to be conversation. And the second step needs to be, you know, for example, rather than saying to someone, I can't believe you just said this negative thing or used this word, on national TV or on the radio, what you can say to them is, when you use that word, it was offensive to me because I identify it as this. Now, you may have used that because you were angry and the anger centers in your brain brought up this particular word. In general, do you think that you have a negative view of this race? Because part of what the studies show is that if you don't blame a prejudiced person immediately and you don't sort of say to them you are immediately prejudiced, part of what happens is they open up to you much more and they actually lose that prejudice much more.
Interesting.
My feeling has been that in a large number of situations, I think that it's counterproductive to bully people into not saying things. I mean, there was an interesting example. It's not exactly prejudice yesterday, but there was a crime committed against a girl, and the Boston mayor made a comment saying something about how angry he was with the people who would have done this, and that if he found out, he would X, Y, and Z. And people said, "How could he say this on national TV?" And they actually interviewed him, and they said to him, "Well, why did you say that?" And he said, "Well, you know, if you're asking me, do I regret saying this kind of thing on TV? Sure, because I wouldn't want to say it on TV. But did I mean it? Yes. And am I human? Yes. And I don't know what to say except that I was very angry." And, you know, it was an interesting description of humanity. And my experience has been that if we can understand and we can try to transform more deeply rather than just changing superficially, we're much more likely to transform what's going on in our environment than if we just try to change superficial behavior.
So are you saying that we kind of need to step back and really look at the fact that we are playing victims at some point?
Yeah, I think everybody at some point feels like a victim in a certain way, but the problem with the victim role is that it doesn't really initiate action toward restoration. Mm. You know, if you have been victimized, you know, there are people who have been clearly victimized. You know, they've been victims of rape, they've been victims of torture, they've been victims of, you know, I mean, there are so many people who would be identifiable as victims of crime. In all of those instances, it's not that I believe they shouldn't know that they've been victims. What I believe is that their victimhood is not their whole identity, and that a large part of their identity is their resilience, and that if they can act out of that empowerment and out of that resilience and then learn to incorporate the horrible events that made them a victim, they will operate out of the fundamental basis of who they are, which is a strong, resilient, surviving human being.
You know, one of the most controversial things about the law of attraction is that we create our own reality. So let me ask you your perception. If someone was raped, did they attract that situation to them, or did they create it? How do you explain that?
Well, it's a complicated question for a number of different reasons. I think, firstly, part of the reason it's hard to summarize that is because I think paramount in my mind when somebody's a victim of any kind of crime is that I do have sympathy for the victim in that instance. So my heart does go out to the person who is the victim of that crime. If we then say, are we attracting that? I think that at some level, we may be. It doesn't absolve the criminal of the crime. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, if you attract negative energy in a certain way, the fact that somebody decides to act on that because they're feeling that, it doesn't necessarily make it right that they've done it. In fact, it's not right that they've done it. But I think whenever we are subjected to negative things in our lives, we have to ask ourselves, what have I done to contribute to this? How have I approached this relationship with the world? You know, if in my mind I believe I am a victim, am I trying to reiterate that identity and therefore seek out predators who will then act on their predatory desires And then I'll say, well, you see, I said I am a victim, and now I am. What that ends up doing is that it ends up asking us, you know, I think what I'm saying is that I don't know that we have enough research to show that in every case it's the same. But I think there's enough information that we can speculate that if we act out of victimhood, we often want to reiterate that identity. And so we may seek experiences that reiterate to us that we are victims. You see this often in situations of repeated domestic abuse. You know, I had a very striking example of that once when I was called to see someone who was a woman who had been very severely physically injured by a situation of domestic abuse. And I was just a trainee then, and I actually walked into the hospital room to begin to speak to her, and I was all set to sort of talk to her about the horror of what had happened, to try to figure out how to get her more protection, to, you know, I had in me a certain judgment about what had happened. And when I went in, she asked me to stand at the door, and she said, don't you come in if you're coming in here to judge my relationship, my decisions, and my life. Because I have made the choices that I've made. And I don't like what's happened, but this is part of a larger choice that I've made. And, you know, it ended up being a very complicated story, because part of what had happened was that she had become addicted to her victimhood. And so she was very possessive of that particular experience, even though it caused that much harm. On the other hand, she also wanted to be a savior, and she lived with someone who was pretty much intolerable and couldn't really live with anybody else. And so part of her felt like she wanted to save him. And to her, her mission of saving him and her desire to retain her victimhood obstructed her ability to see that this physical harm was damaging her, not just physically, but psychologically as well. And my sense is that when you work with people like that, you know, I think a lot of people who are victims are reluctant to understand their attachment to their victimhood and are reluctant to give up that attachment. I think all of us, if we look at our lives, we will see that there's at least one area where we're not excelling, an area where we could excel, because something about keeping ourselves back is part of our identity. You know, I think it was Marion Williamson, who I also quote in the book, who said that our greatest fear is not that we are weak. Our greatest fear is our own strength. And so for a lot of people, admitting to having that strength is threatening. It makes them feel like they're not going to get the love they need, that they're not going to get the care they need, because they feel that they have to remain vulnerable in order to get that love. And the truth is, it's very possible to be loved if you're strong. And it's very possible to be loved because regardless of what you do, you're always going to have some human vulnerability. And if you have intimacy in your life, the person you're intimate with is going to be able to see that and appreciate that vulnerability in you. There's no need for us to attach ourselves to that vulnerability to limit our lives. We're much more likely to manifest things that we want to manifest if we manifest them out of our strength.
For those of you who have tuned in late, I just want to let you know that we are talking to Sarini Pillay, MD, who is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School in Boston. And he is here telling us that the law of attraction is authentic and real, biologically. And I also want to remind you of his book, Life Unlocked, 7 Revolutionary Lessons to Overcome Fear. Now, for more information about Dr. Pillay, simply go to SariniPillay.com. That's SariniPillay.com. And you can go to any bookstore to find his book, Life Unlocked. Doctor, what is the main message that you want to leave all of the listeners tonight?
Well, what I'd like to say is that the reason I wrote this book was because I wanted people to have something to hold on to, and that Life Unlocked is really about taking, even if you take 2 to 3 steps from the entire book to change your life, the mission of the book will have been accomplished. And so I hope that people who understand that they have this potential and who want to manifest it will pick up this book and try out some of what the recommendations are after reading the descriptions, so that they can further their lives beyond the point that they're at right now.
I wholeheartedly recommend this book. I urge everyone to go out and get this book, look at it, practice with it, and it will be your guide in changing your life. And if that law of attraction doesn't work for you now, this has the answer in there for you. Thank you so much for coming on to Law of Attraction Talk Radio and sharing all of this information.
And thank you very much for having me on the show. It's really awesome to talk to you.
And would you come back on and share with us even more studies as they come up?
I would love that. It would be my honor. Thank you so much. You know, I think this message is such an important message that you're spreading. And I think the idea that you're disseminating it in the way that you are and sort of finding people to represent that message, it's a really important mission in the world. And I'm so glad that it's you that's doing it, because I can feel it in your heart.
Well, thank you. You know, coming from you, that really means a lot. Well, that completes another show that I'm absolutely so thrilled to have brought you. Have a great week. Think positive. Think hopeful. Start creating. And go out and get his book, Life Unlocked. I'll see you all back here next week. Have a great one. Bye-bye. Thank you for joining us on Law of Attraction Talk Radio with Jules. For more information, go to Law of Attraction Radio Network at lawofattracttalkradio.com or lawofattractiontools.com.